And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
This morning in Rocky Mountain National Park, a male elk bugled out from the mountain ledge that he was looking for a mate. In New York City, a gray squirrel quickly cached an oak seed for later retrieval. And in the Atlantic Ocean, a giant leatherback sea turtle continued her move eastward, one which began 1,800 miles earlier from the coast of South America after laying her eggs on a soft sand shore. And along the Gulf Coast, vast stretches lie in ruin from Hurricane Katrina. Life indeed goes on in its many manifest ways. When I return with your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Hello, and welcome to you from the sunny shores of the Pacific Ocean. There are few real words to describe anymore the real story of Katrina. There is no single story of survival or suffering, ocean surge or strength, that will do justice to the scale of destruction that we are witnessing. For those who must live with it now as we speak, we offer our hope-filled thoughts and prayers. The recovery will test the strength of our nation and challenge the American spirit in ways we in this generation have never before faced. There is plenty of justifiable talk about the failures associated with the storm. It is not finger-pointing or blaming for those of us who sat watching the story emerge 2 weeks ago this Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, who jumped from our couches and yelled out for help and wondered why there was no obvious sense of urgency from our federal government. We in America have prided ourselves with our ability to respond to crisis, but it seems that of late, the perceived common sense of the American people has been regularly ignored, spurned, and ridiculed by a new form of Americanism hell-bent on forging a new dream for the world. Damn the consequences. Well, the consequences of such arrogance are now being revealed as the floodwaters are pumped from what was New Orleans, as hundreds of thousands fled for their lives, and as hundreds of thousands could not. There comes a time in almost every ill-conceived master plan when the water hits the wall, and it did. And no matter how hard some will try, the facts remain. And it is now an epical moment in the history of not only the world, but more personally, America. Today, we keep moving forward, as we must as we continue to bring you the saga of the American environmental movement. After all, the warnings and concerns of environmental consequences have been the battle cry of the activists who pressure, through various means, the forces of power to wake up and realize that you don't mess with Mother Nature for too long. This past weekend in San Francisco, the granddaddy of all environmental organizations, the Sierra Club, had an historic conference which brought over 4,000 of its members into a hall to rechart their course as the changing social, political, economic, and environmental realities demand new thinking and action to meet the emerging challenge. In parts 2 and 3, we talk with Greg Cassini, a board member of the Sierra Club, who was instrumental in bringing this conference to consensus about how the environmental community is learning to communicate from community to nation to world. And following the news, we talk with Brant Olson with the Rainforest Action Network about their continuing work to preserve the Grand Forest through concerted, conscientious action on the ground and in the boardrooms of those with power and the resources which affect the face of our forests and our future. It's a show of today and of tomorrow. So first, the news. In the wake of Hurricane Katrina lies the nation's largest total damage figure. Quickly jumping from first estimates of $40 billion, the best estimate as of today is $125 billion, with some estimates saying $160 billion or more. The insurance industry is already digging deep to come up with the estimated $60 billion in damage compensation that they will have to coffer up to rebuild the devastated Gulf states. In New Orleans, estimates of $10 billion just for road repairs gives a sense of the caliber of the storm's economic and social impact. As yet, the true scope of damage to the natural environment has not been determined. Louisiana's Secretary for the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries estimated that there would be massive destruction of the habitat in the coastal area, rich in wildlife and fisheries. Particularly hard hit will be the shrimp and oyster industries, as the storm knocked out so much of the infrastructure supporting these markets. As well, the recreation industry will take a long time to recover as boats, docks, and supporting businesses assess the capacity to attract their normal clients. As Lake Pontchartrain takes the fusty waters from the flooded city of New Orleans, concerns about what will happen to downriver areas of the Gulf are unknown. Any filter feeders, such as oysters, process these contaminants into their systems. Close monitoring will be in order. Of course, in every tragedy, there comes the potentials for something good. And that is what is getting certain legislators a bit gleeful. Last week, Congressman Joe Barton of Texas and Chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee described the possibility that the hurricane might increase public support for expanded drilling as a, quote, silver lining, and called for lifting offshore drilling restrictions and for drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Other congressional leaders are exploiting the Katrina aftermath in an effort to rush through opening of protected areas to oil and gas drilling. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, Resources Committee Chairman Richard Combo, and Senator Pete Domenici, who recently helped push through the National Energy Bill as chairman of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, announced his intent to open protected offshore areas by saying, "I'm going to go after OCS, the Outer Continental Shelf." David Jenkins, Government Affairs Director for REP, Republicans for Environmental Protection, offered a different perspective on the Katrina aftermath. "At a time when our party should be providing forward-thinking leadership on energy, it is truly unfortunate that some choose instead to exploit current events and perpetuate Americans' dangerous dependence on oil," Jenkins said. "It is time for our Republican leaders to step up and act in the long-term interest of the American people rather than the short-time interests of the oil and gas industry." And while we drown in the swirl of the spinmeisters, let's go ahead and give you the latest from the World Health Organization. Margaret Chan, responsible for helping defend the world against an influenza pandemic that could kill millions, says an outbreak of bird flu among humans may be imminent. "The good news is that it may not be too late, or more precisely, it may not be too late to delay the spread of the pandemic, which is predicted to put 25 million people into the hospitals and cause 7 million deaths globally within a short period. In comparison, the current death toll from Katrina stands at just under 1,000, with thousands more expected as the final search continues." And while the aftermath of Katrina mysteriously pushes the price of oil down, at least temporarily, the longer-term pricing may not be as kind. The worldwide oil crisis that is looming is seeing a grab by nations for existing stocks and reserves, and some nations and businesses have decided to cash in on the new opportunity. China recently bought up the Encana company with oil reserves in Ecuador, South America's second largest source of American oil imports, as it quietly buys up global production. The new oil firm, Andean, will be wholly owned by CNPC, the Chinese petroleum giant. And finally, for anyone wanting something solid to hitch your sails to, 11 endangered leatherback turtles have donned satellite transmitters, then released from various spots on the shores of the Atlantic Ocean to see what they do. The leatherback turtles are the world's largest turtles, whose shells can reach as much as 5 feet in diameter. In a little over 2.5 months, Aitkina, the sea turtle, has covered over 1,800 open ocean miles and dived to nearly 2,000 feet. Each of the turtles travels are being tracked and displayed on a special web page provided by the parent sponsor, the World Wildlife Fund, WWF, and can be viewed at www.panda.org. Amongst all of the chaos, confusion, and catastrophe that fills our news these days, it is good to know that in many respects, the wild wonders continue in their personal sagas of survival. May we all learn to listen, learn, and take action to keep the wonder alive. And that's the news. The Wild Side News continues to bring you the stories you will not hear anywhere else. Tell your friends. Spread the news. And now we turn our attentions to this call to action from the Rainforest Action Network. With all the talk about Katrina in the news these days, which certainly is justified because it is a monumental natural disaster, as well as economic and social crisis for America right now. Nevertheless, although it is a huge story, it is not the only story, and there are groups still working all over the country here to make a difference and around the world. And one of those groups is the Rainforest Action Network, which is very busy continuing its work on campaigns that it's already started. And joining us now is Brant Olson with the Rainforest Action Network, which you can visit at ran.org. Brant, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
First of all, for people who haven't heard about the Rainforest Action Network, why don't you give us a summary of what your mission and vision is?
Sure. Rainforest Action Network has been around for about 20 years. In fact, this year we're celebrating our 20th anniversary. And for all of those 20 years, we've been working to protect the world's endangered forests, including the rainforest, certainly, but more than that. Forests globally are certainly under severe threat from industrial forestry. So we've been working for the last couple of decades to protect those forests and the rights of their inhabitants. And we've done that mainly through engaging the marketplace directly. So while others may fight legal battles or do lobbying on Capitol Hill, we prefer to go directly to the corporations that are responsible for environmental destruction.
And that actually brings us to the topic of today's discussion, and that is some work that you're focusing on in Oregon and Washington. Why don't you give us a background on that?
Sure. Well, for several years, Rainforest Action Network and a network of allies really all over the country and at one point all over the world had been focusing in on a company called Boise Cascade. And Boise Cascade at that time had been doing logging of old growth forests in the United States, just particularly in the Pacific Northwest, as well as importing a number of products from overseas that were having a hugely detrimental impact on rainforest ecosystems abroad. And so after several years of campaigning in 2003, the company actually adopted a policy to stay out of old growth forests and a number of other measures, including screening all of their international purchasing from illegal logging. And that was a real achievement. They were the first company, first American company, to make a commitment to stay out of old growth areas. And we were real pleased at that development. Well, in the intervening years since 2003, the company has gone through a lot of changes. The management and the executive team at the top has changed over. They spun off a couple of their divisions so that the forest lands themselves are actually privately owned now by another entity. And their paper distribution division has now been wrapped into Office Max. So it's a very different company. But the policy that they adopted in 2003, we believe, should still apply. And so we were very concerned when we saw that they had removed this landmark agreement from the company's website and simultaneously moved into two old growth areas of national forests in Oregon and Washington. And so you can imagine, you know, all of the folks that worked real hard leading up to 2003 in that agreement with Boise were pretty concerned. And so what we've done is kind of gone back out to that network of supporters, particularly those local folks in Oregon and Washington concerned with these national forests, and launched a campaign to remind the company that they have a commitment. So we've been tying green ribbons on trees in these areas that are scheduled to be logged. And we've also gone back to Boise, Idaho, where the company is headquartered, hanging green ribbons all around town to remind the community and to remind Boise themselves that they have a commitment to uphold. And we feel that, you know, if Boise really is a trustworthy company, then they'll keep that agreement that they made with us and really with all of Americans back in 2003.
I really think the idea of green ribbons is a sensationally powerful, positive pressure point to place on the company. For people in the area, how can you help us understand where these specific locations are in Washington and in Oregon? Where would people find these on a map?
Well, in Washington, it's an area in the Wenatchee National Forest. So that's just south of Wenatchee, east on the east side of the Cascades, if you know where that is.
Mm-hmm.
So, Seattle, it's going to be about five or six hours east of Seattle on the other side of the Cascade Mountain Range.
Mm-hmm.
And in the specific area there, it's called the Eagle Late Successional area. And so the late successional designation actually is a designation by the Forest Service that's actually trying to regrow old growth characteristics. So clearly this is old growth in an area that Boise should stay out of. In Oregon, we're talking about an area that's in the Deschutes National Forest. Again, this is on the east side, the east side of the state, on the east side of the range there. So it's not the coastal forests that a lot of folks, I think, would, that go up the I-5 corridor would recognize. But it's on the east side of the mountain, and it's certainly critical habitat.
In terms of the green ribbons themselves, I mean, are you supplying these? Or do you encourage people to get their own green ribbon? How's that happening?
It really is a grassroots effort, and it's actually an idea that grew out of the town of Leavenworth, which is real close to where the logging is scheduled to happen in Washington. And so that really just kind of grew organically out of that area. And then we have, the ability to contact a much broader list of folks. You know, we have supporters, more than 30,000 supporters nationwide. And so we put out the call, to our network to say, tie a green ribbon in your community to show some solidarity with folks that care about protecting old growth forests.
So in reality, although it started in that area, this is becoming a national campaign throughout the United States to protect our American old growth forests.
Absolutely. We don't have much left. There's only about 4% of America's original old growth forests that still remain. Most folks want to make sure that those areas are preserved. And so especially for the areas that aren't protected as parks, folks care about these areas. Most people are shocked to learn that national forests, particularly old growth areas of our national forests, are available to be commercially logged. So in this case, particularly when you have a company who's made a promise to stay out of these areas, it's important to raise a fuss when these areas come under threat. So hopefully we'll be able to raise the profile of this issue. We'll be able to put a little heat under the feet of Boise Cascade and keep these areas protected.
I know that RAND very often does a face-to-face with the major players in companies. Have you had a chance to do that in this particular situation? And if so, what has been their justification for this change?
We have. Soon after we learned about this issue, we put a call in to the CEO of Boise Cascade, Tom Stevens, and he actually flew out to our offices in San Francisco. We had we met for the better part of a morning, kind of outlining our concerns. And we were encouraged that the company came to listen. I think that this was, one half desire on the company's part to make money, as they tend, as companies tend to want to do. The other half, I think, was just the fact that this was a whole new executive team, and they didn't quite understand a lot of the commitments that had been made back in 2003. So part of our work and part of the reason why we asked for the meeting was really to make sure that this policy remained meaningful at the company, that this type of market activism that we call it, so this type of lobbying corporate America, essentially, is sort of a new face or a new wave of the environmental movement that I think corporate executives really need to recognize. And so this was kind of our effort to underscore the importance of this issue with the CEO. I think he understands that getting into controversies like this isn't in the best business interest of the company, that really, if you're going into areas that you don't have the social contract to log, and at the end, when folks are considering what paper to buy or considering where to shop for their, wood products or other consumer products, it's going to have an effect on the company. Boise felt that back in 2003, and that's why they adopted the policy. And this was just a little reminder to say that, you know, we're still here. Consumers are still paying attention to environmental issues, and, you know, we're encouraging you to do the right thing.
Were you personally involved in that meeting?
I was, yeah.
And without getting too personal, I'm just curious, what were you witnessing in terms of the CEO's response? I mean, quite honestly, maybe he just really didn't know. You know, I mean, a new guy comes in, a new team comes in, and there's a period of kind of figuring out what the company's all about and how they operate. Did you see sort of a change in his perceptions or his thinking as you talked with him?
Well, that's a good question, you know, and I don't want to read too much into his own intentions or the intentions of his team there. And I, as I said, you know, I think this is probably half misunderstanding, but I think the other half is, you know, we need to pay attention to, which is that clearly, you know, this policy was on the books at Boise Cascade, and clearly in the decision-making of foresters and other decision-makers at the company, this environmental policy and environmental affairs generally are playing second seat to the bottom line. And so what our message was to, you know, clarify for the company that there really is a triple bottom line. You need to be taking care of not only your investors on the bottom line, but you also need to be taking care of the environment, you also need to be taking care of the communities in which you operate. And so that triple bottom line theory is really one that's catching on, I think, in corporate America. Increasingly, we're finding studies that are showing that companies that do pay attention to the environment and set standards and benchmarks and measure themselves on their environmental performance and their community engagement, as well as their bottom line, are really outperforming the competition. So that business case, I think, is an important one to make with companies, and I think we made it pretty well, and I think it was I think we're being listened to. So whether or not these particular areas ultimately will be logged by Boise Cascade, I don't know, but I'm hopeful. Further on down the road, long term, I think that Boise is going to recognize that, you know, keeping to that triple bottom line commitment is really going to improve their business practices across the board.
Well, certainly commitments made and the responsibility to keep those to the public deals with integrity, and I'm sure that Boise Cascade really doesn't want to be suddenly perceived as a company that doesn't keep those commitments, because these are extremely important things, particularly now as we head into the future where issues of global warming and our environment are becoming the paramount story on the planet right now at every level. And just to take this a step further in relationship to the Katrina issue, because some people are saying, here go the Brazilian rainforest, for example, to supply the wood to rebuild that whole region. What are you hearing about sort of the future of the forests now that Katrina has left its wake of damage and destruction?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the meeting that we did have with the Tom Stevens, CEO of Boise, here our offices happened, you know, less than a week after the Katrina hurricane had rolled through, and the recovery efforts were still trying to kind of pick up steam. We both identified in that meeting the importance of finding ways of helping Katrina that aren't going to sacrifice environmental values. And so there's a real opportunity, I think, to, you know, when the rebuilding does begin, to consider how we can rebuild a community, or how we can build a community essentially from the bottom up in an environmentally responsible way. So, you know, there are products out there. There are green, you know, the green building is a concept that's really catching on, I think, in today's marketplace. I'm actually headed to D.C. here in a couple of weeks to go meet with the U.S. Council of Green Builders, which is a network of thousands of builders all over the country that that are grading themselves essentially on the environmental friendliness of the communities and the neighborhoods that they're building. So I think there's a real excellent opportunity to rebuild in a way that's going to be environmentally friendly and ultimately more. Not only more responsible in terms of our global obligations, but also cost-effective, which I think is also very important. You know, energy efficient, using things like passive solar designs in order to cut down on energy costs, and using alternative products that mean that we don't have to go back to the old-growth forests and in order to find the building materials that we need.
What are people discussing in terms of alternatives to wood? What could people think about? Because this is a huge cleanup and rebuilding, huge project. And if we, I'm just curious, what are people suggesting?
Well, and it goes beyond just alternatives to wood. I mean, certainly alternatives to some of the most, and you know, alternatives to logging in environmentally sensitive areas is really what we're talking about here. And so if you are going to buy wood, green builders would say that you need to do it with certified wood. So the Forest Stewardship Council is an international body that essentially says that this wood was taken from an area that was logged responsibly, as opposed to, you know, in a sensitive rainforest, say, in Indonesia or Malaysia, or as opposed to, you know, an old-growth forest in British Columbia or the Pacific Northwest. So, you know, there are, say, you know, timber plantations that are being planted on former agricultural land in Chile or elsewhere. These are more responsible ways to get our wood. But, you know, it's also important to underscore some of the alternatives as well. So advanced framing technique is simply a way to reduce the amount of wood that one would use when building a home or a commercial space. And there's all sorts of techniques that and products available that can minimize the environmental impact from building.
Now, if people wish to participate and learn more, what would you recommend? There's kind of two ways to go about this. One would be on the local level to discuss or share ideas personally with the Boise Cascade in a responsible way, and the other would be through RAND. What are some of your suggestions on how to accomplish those?
Well, the best thing that you can do is really empower yourself by knowing what the impacts, the environmental impacts and other impacts, frankly, of your buying choices are. So are the products that you're buying being sourced in environmentally responsible ways? And some easy tools are available on the web to help you out with that. So I would encourage folks to visit www.fscus.org. That's the Forest Stewardship Council. And also, if folks are interested in green building, whether they're developers or whether you're just trying to build a new home, the U.S. Green Building Council has some great resources available. So on the web, that's usgbc.org.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, I certainly appreciate your being on the show and adding your voice to the voice of the earth here. I'd like to perhaps do a follow-up when you come back from the Green Building Conference to hear what people are talking about. I think that could be very useful at this particular time.
Love to come back.
Okay. Brant Olson with the Rainforest Action Network, I want to thank you for being on the Wild Side News.
All right. Thank you very much.
Brant Olson makes the most important point. Please, wherever and however you can, encourage everyone to look for the FSC label on wood products from your local hardware stores as the rebuilding begins. We are forced to make choices now. Let those choices be made with the knowledge that through wise choices, we can help to save this earth. When we return, we go out west to San Francisco, where the great redwoods inspired long ago the master of the mystery, John Muir, to walk and write his way right into the middle of our time. From him grew the Sierra Club, which this last week said it's time for us to think anew. We hear that story when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.